numbers, and then we'll figure out how to calculate real numbers, and then we'll discuss some of the kind of experiments that we want to do and some of the measurements that people are currently doing. And that will bring you to a point where you can actually understand current papers, and you can sit in talks, and you can not only understand what is the motivation for what people are doing, but actually follow the details of why they're calculating what they're calculating. And then at the end, we'll recap and put everything we have learned the last week and a half in context and see why we have done what we have done. All right? So some real numbers. The nice thing about high energy physics is that C equal to 1 is not just a way to decide on units, but it's actually what the physics does, right? Everything is pretty much moving at the speed of light. So we choose C equal to 1 also because of unit convenience, but it also, we're not going to see any velocities appearing anywhere in any of our expressions because everything pretty much is beta equal to 1. H bar equal to 1 is convenient, but actually it sometimes obscures the fact that some things are classical and some things are quantum. But anyway, it's a convenient unit. So now, given those units, there are some very simple ways that, if you haven't seen it before, I'm going to give it to you now, but I think it's worth memorizing, because once you know those things, you can pretty much write what is the correct numbers for any kind of expression, or what you can generally do dimensional analysis. So with these units, length is measured in units of inverse mass, right? Mass is or inverse energy. Mass is measured in units of energy, right? And do I need anything else? And time, right? This time is measured in units of length because C equal to 1, and so it's also measured in units of inverse energy. Now, the kind of units that we will be using is mostly electron volts. Electron volts, kilo electron volts, mega electron volts. So just in case you forgot, kilo electron volt is 10 to the 3 electron volts. Mega electron volts, which is the mass of the electron, is 10 to the 6. And giga electron volt is 10 to the 9. And finally, the energy frontier, where we are today, is 10 to the 12 electron volts. All right, so these are the units that we will use. Those are units of energy. And so all those other quantities we will be using with electron volts. And the mnemonics that will help you convert to all those energies, we'll see in a moment how we do dimensional analysis, but the kind of units that will be helpful for you is, well, how do we convert from mass to these sort of units? Normally, you're used to measuring mass in units of kilogram. There is a very simple currency conversion. If you only remember what is the mass of the proton, you can immediately do this conversion. You know that the proton weighs roughly 1.6 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms, right? And in these units, the proton weighs a GeV. Okay, so so this divided by GeV has to be equal to 1. Okay, you understand what I mean? In these units, where H bar and C is equal to 1, this has to be equal to a GeV, and so if you divide, you get 1. So now, whenever we talk about any kind of mass in GeV units, if you ever want to convert it to real people's units, this is how you do it. So for example, something that could be very useful, no, you don't really care about talking about people in GeV, but what about the sun? Sometimes you would like to know what is the weight of the sun in GeV or something, if you talk about all those sort of exotic processes that happen in the sun. Well, the sun in units of kilograms, if some of you might know, it's 10 to the 30 kilograms. So how do you convert it to a GeV? You just multiply this by 1, right? So we know that this is 1. So GeV over 1.6 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms is 1. So I can just, I can always multiply it. And then I get the answer for the mass of the sun in kilograms, sorry, in GeV. Okay? That can also give you immediately how many particles roughly you have in the sun, because the sun is mostly made out of hydrogen. Hydrogen weighs roughly as much as the proton. The proton is a GeV, so this is roughly how many particles you have in the sun, 10 to the 57. Okay? So things get much simpler once you start using those units, but there are a couple more such currency conversions. The other very, very useful currency conversion is that 0.2 GeV is a length scale of 10 to the minus 15 meters. So this is also equal to 1. Okay? So, for example, if you wanted to know what is a Bohr radius, right? Roughly what is the size of an atom? How would you do it? If you didn't know about this little trick, you'd have to remember where to put the C, where to put the H bar. But now we're living in a world where C and H bar equal to 1. What could possibly the Bohr radius be? Well, it's dimension of 1 over energy. So whatever I'm putting on the right-hand side has to have those same dimensions. So the only dimension in the problem is the mass of the electron. The only thing that this could be is the mass of the electron. So I know that it has to go like m electron to the inverse power, right? Because I know that length scale goes like energy inverse. But there is one thing I'm missing here, and that is the fact that this system would never be a bound system if you didn't have electromagnetism. Right, so something it has to know about the strengths of electromagnetism, and I know that as I decrease the coupling, the system will get larger and larger. Right, so I know it has to go like inverse alpha. Now, there's nothing that tells you that it's inverse alpha versus, you know, minus 2 or minus 3. You just know that it's 1 over alpha, or a greater power. But it turns out to be actually just exactly that. So that's it. Now I just have to use this little conversion factor. I know that. This is alpha is 1 over 37, so I just get 137 here. And m electron is 0.5 MeV. But now I wanted to have this in human beings units. So 0.2 GeV is 200 MeV, so I just multiply this quantity by 1. From there I see that 1 is equal to 200 MeV divided by 10 to the minus 15 meters, right? In my units, this ratio is 1. And so I can cancel the MeV, and I get 2 goes up, that's a 4. 4 times 137, that's roughly 40,000, so maybe 50,000. So that's roughly 5 times 10 to the 4 times 10 to the... I shouldn't divide this. It's a multiplication, not division. 1 is 200 MeV times 10 to the minus 15. Okay, so then I get 10 to the 4 times 10 to the minus 15 meters, and I get the answer that it's roughly 5 times 10 to the minus 11 meters. That's roughly 1 angstrom, right, which is the right answer. Okay, so you don't have to remember anymore any numbers. You can just remember those conversion factors and roughly how much things weigh in these units of electron volts. All right, so this is how you can... The mistake I made is important. It's not a ratio, right? It's the product of the two that is equal to 1. And now finally, the last conversion factor. So this is, as you all know, this is just roughly 1 angstrom, 10 to the minus 10 meters. So the last conversion factor is something that you actually don't really need to remember because you know the speed of light. So the conversion factor we want to have is to know how to go from time. We know that time is also measured in inverse energy. So we want to know how to go from time to inverse energy. We just have to know the speed of light. And I can just multiply by one. I can just multiply this by one, right? Because the speed of light is just one. And so 0.2 times GV times 10 to the minus 15 meters times 1 over the speed of light, which is 3 times 10 to the eight meter per second, right? So the meters cancel, the second goes up, and I get 0.6 times 10 to the minus 24. 24. GV second is equal to 1. Okay. Now, why is this important? So now you have a conversion factor between GV and seconds. Because now you can very quickly estimate how long processes take. Subatomic processes like electromagnetic processes, the decay of atoms, the decay of nuclear processes. If you know roughly the energy scales that you're talking about, this tells you how fast those processes happen. So for example, the Z boson, which is a pretty exotic particle, often you need something much less exotic than that, but the Z boson has a width of roughly 2 GeV. So the width of the Z boson is roughly 2 GeV, if I remember it correctly. So now you can estimate what is the lifetime associated with it. You know that the lifetime is just the inverse of the width, and so we can just multiply this by 1, and 1 in our case is 0.6 times 10 to the minus 24 seconds times the GeV. The GeV cancels, and you just get 0.3 times 10 to the minus 24 seconds. Incredibly fast, right? The lifetime of the Z particle is something that is just unimaginable for us. So this particle just leaves just the briefest moment. Okay, and the top particle, I think, is also roughly that sort of time scale. All right, so these conversion factors, if you do particle physics or high-energy physics in general, are just extremely useful. You use them again and again and again, and if you just remember them, those simple rules, you can convert almost anything. Okay, the only thing it doesn't tell you is how to convert magnetic fields, but there is a conversion currency for that as well. All right, so now let's try to use this to figure out what kind of processes and we have and how fast they occur. But before I do so, any questions on the meaning of this business? You all good with numbers? Okay. So now let's talk about the kind of things we can measure. And one of the main things that I'll mention is cross-sections. So have you all seen cross-sections before? Right? Do you mind if I go over it once again just so it's completely clear in your mind? All right, so there are different ways you can define cross-sections and talk about it, but there is one very intuitive way of talking about it that is also very relevant for those large colliders that take two beams and collide them to each other. You can think about it as we have some bunch of particles in one of the beams. Right? So here is the first bunch. This is actually how they do it. Those beams are made up of little bunches that get circulated in those huge detectors, and they collide them. So what gets collided is really a bunch of particles, not just a single particle. Okay, so this is the first bunch. And let's say it has lengths L1. And it's moving towards this direction. And then I have another bunch. Right? And it also has some dimension L2, whatever, doesn't really matter. Let's just call both of them L. It's not going to matter for anything that we're going to do. And it's moving this way, right? Now, what you want to know at the zeroth order approximation is just how many collisions are going to happen, how many times those things are going to collide. So you want to have a pure number. You want to calculate a pure number, the number of collisions. So what could it depend on? Well, it certainly depends on the density here and the density here. So this should go like the number density in the first one times the length, right? And times the number density in the second one times the length of the second one, right? Because you once they go through each other, you feel the entire length of those bunches. Okay? Now, this has dimensions of 1/m². This has dimensions of 1m². So I still need to get some meter to the fourth dimensions here. Now, clearly, how many collisions you have also depends on what is the overlap in area, right? If I displace those two things away from each other, they're just going to cross without any collisions. And in fact, this is what they do. Initially, where they just circulate the beams, they don't focus them on each other. And the beams just can just go away, through each other without ever seeing the particles. When they actually want to see collisions, they have little focusing magnets that steer the beams this way towards each other, right? So what is the effective area they see is also important. And so we multiply this quantity by some effective area that is the overlap of those two bunches. All right, so that gives us a factor of m². And so, but to get a pure number, I'm still missing some quantity here to multiply this whole thing by some quantity that has dimensions of length square. And that quantity is what we call the cross section. Okay? We usually denote it by sigma, and it has units of m², meter square. All right? This is the definition of the cross section. It's that quantity that when multiplied by this part gives you how many collisions you'll see. Now notice conceptually there is a very deep separation here. This whole thing has something to do with the detector, something to do with the engineers that constructed the detector, the detector physicists that collider physicists that made the machine. It has everything to do with those bunches. Huh? Yeah? It has everything to do with the bunches themselves. It has nothing to do with particle physics. It has nothing to do with what the particles actually do. All right? So this part here just has to do with the machine itself. This part here, the cross section, has everything to do with the particles and nothing to do with the detector. You can measure the same quantity in many different detectors and you'll get the same result. Right? Because it has something to do with what happens when, if we enlarge this picture when they collide, what happens when a single particle sees another particle and how they collide. Okay? So the cross section really has to do with the particle-particle collisions. This entire thing, which we call it the luminosity, not the Lagrangian, just the luminosity, is a property of the machine itself. If you go and read papers that are written by those big detectors like ATLAS, CMS, you will always see that in the abstract, they tell you what was their luminosity that they used to give you the result that they give you. Why is it? It's because if you care for, and we'll see it again in a moment, if you care about any kind of process that they might measure, you have in mind what is the relevant cross-section. But if you want to know how many events did they actually see, you need to know what is their luminosity, right? And we'll do it in actual numbers in a moment. But you need to know this number if you want to know how many actual events they saw, because if this number is, if you multiply this by that, and you get a number that is less than one, you're done, right? You know that they didn't see any event. Because this number is an integer. or I should say that this is an integer, right? So if you get a number which is less than one, that's too bad. Your process may be the most, the sexiest process in the world, but we'll never see it, right? And so this number is something that we really will not deal with, and I doubt that any of you will ever deal with in your life. It really has something to do with machine design. This is the numbers that you really care for as a theoretical particle physicist. This is what you want to calculate. All right? Okay, but this is not the only thing that you want to do. Usually you want to do something a lot more interesting than just calculating this raw number. You often want to ask, well, so if I had this collision here, right? So if I had this particle coming in and another one coming in, what happens? By how much did those particles deflect? Right? So there is some angle by which those particles deflected, or whatever they collided into deflected. And you might want to ask, in a little angle, theta, how many events did I see? Right? So what you would do is that you would take the differential, right? If you want to ask how many little things were seen in an event theta, you take a differential. Well, this doesn't get differentiated because this just has something to do with the machine. So the only thing that gets differentiated is the cross-section. Right? So now you can start talking about differential quantities. Not just number of events and total cross-section, but rather the number of events in a little angle compared to the is something that you get from getting the differential cross-section. Right? So this little angle is if you want to know how many of them got scattered into this solid angle, right? So this is d theta. So how many of them got spewed into this angle? This is what you'll have to do. What you care for, what you do as a theoretical physicist, you calculate this side. What experimentalists can measure for you is this side.
So in the luminosity, when we're setting it up, we are treating somehow the particles as possible particles. So
yep.
Is there a correction that is necessary for that? Or
not really. The densities that they're talking about is not that high, so you don't need to worry about interparticle interaction or something like that. I mean, when you actually derive those things properly, you treat those as wave packets,
right,
and you go through the whole rigmarole. But there's no real quantum effects in this beam, right? So okay, so this is something I want you again. There is a very nice separation here between experiment and theory. As a theorist, this is what you calculate. As an experimentalist, this is what you measure, and interchanging this data is what you talk to when you talk to each other. Yeah.
So is that the number of interaction per second? Because I think it depends on the relative velocity between the two beams.
That's right. So here I've just talked about a total luminosity. So this is the total luminosity of like in half a year. But you're right that often what the more important number for operating the machine is what is the instantaneous luminosity. So it's the luminosity per second. And the luminosity per second will tell you how many events per second. But that's a detail that is not really important for pretty much anything you'll do, because whenever you read a paper by one of those large collaborations, they won't really discuss the instantaneous luminosity. They'll discuss the integrated luminosity or the total luminosity over the period where the analysis was done. So for example, if you go and suppose you got really interested in stop production, something will do. So this is the supersymmetric top. And you want to know what searches have looked for that particle. You would go and read on the archive and search by Atlas for stops, and they will tell you that they have searched for it with this much data. And what will they quote? What will they quote as their data? They will quote the total luminosity, and that will allow you to figure out how many events you'll see. Okay, so we'll see it in a moment. So this is a very nice separation, but as we said, we should not be measuring things in meter square, right? We should really like to measure things in energy. So let's see how we can understand the kind of cross-sections we get just from dimensional analysis. Okay, so we mentioned stop production, or more generally, new physics production. So let's see, just based on dimension analysis, what is the size of cross sections we expect to get? Okay. So last time you guys gave me two kind of processes that we may be able to look for, right? Electron positron so this is E plus, E minus to selectron, anti-selectron, right? Another nice process you gave me was the same initial state, but now it's, you get it by interchanging an electron, right? So in fact, those diagrams interfere with each other, right? Something like that, right? Now, of course, the details would matter, and at some point you really have to calculate those things, but just based on dimension analysis, we can already figure out what is the cross-section of these processes. Well, what is the energy? What is the mass scale associated with these processes? The mass scale, unless you are at energies much above the mass of those particles, the mass scale associated with these processes is just the mass of the selectron. Let's call it Me tilde. So if I want to know what is the cross-section, I know that the cross-section has dimensions of length square, right? It has dimensions of length square. If it has dimension of length square, it means that it has dimensions of energy of 1 over energy square, right? So this has to go like something to 1 over energy square. Well, what is that energy square? It's the mass of the selectron, right? So I know that this has to go like 1 over the mass of the selectron square. Now, this is good, but it's not accurate enough. What am I missing? What do I also know that this cross-section has to go as? Well, if I turn off the interaction, I'm not going to get anything, right? So somehow I need to know about this interaction here. And since this is electromagnetic in this case, right? In this case, it's a little different, actually. It's even smaller, in fact. But in this case, it's electromagnetic, and I have 1 power of the electromagnetic coupling here, 1 power of the electromagnetic coupling here, but it gets squared because you're doing a matrix element squared, and so you expect to get the fine structure constant here time to the second power. All right? And that's it, pretty much. There'll be other factors like, you know, 1 over 2, 1 over 4, all that stuff, but ballpark, you get the right answer. So now we can estimate what this answer is, right? So this just gives alpha square is roughly 10 to the minus 2 square. So that gives me 10 to the minus 4. The mass of the selectron, well, we haven't seen them yet. We have bounds on those particles. Those bounds give us something like 100 GeV. That's roughly the mass of the Higgs boson. Somewhere around there, that's where the bound on the selectron is. And so we can put in 100 GeV square. And now I can convert it to human beings' units, right? Because I have this nice conversion factor, I just have to multiply by it. So let's multiply by 0.2 times 10 to the minus 15 meters GeV square. This is just 1, right? I remind you, this factor is just 1. So I'm always allowed to multiply by 1. GeV cancels. And I get 10 to the minus 4, this is 10 to the minus 8. This gives me 4 times 10 to the minus 30 meters square. And it gives me 10 to the minus 38 meters square. And that's a tiny, tiny cross-section, and it probably doesn't mean anything to you, and it won't mean anything to you until you actually read a paper that tells you what is the luminosity, right? Because to know whether this cross-section is large or small, you need to know how many times you have collided those things. So what are the kind of units that you would usually read? If you go to the papers today, you would find, for example, that ATLAS have analyses nowadays with 14 inverse femtobarns. Okay, what is that unit? Well, a barn, is equal to 10 to the minus 28 meters square. Okay? So how many barns do I have here? I have roughly, there was a factor of 4 here, so I have roughly 10 to the minus 10 barns. Right? And that is equal to 10 to the minus 10 to the 2 femto barns. Remember, femto is 10 to the minus 15. Sorry, no, I'm screwing it up. 10 to the pico barn. 10 to the minus, I apologize. 10 to the minus 10, that's, 10 to the 2 pico barn. Right, 10 to the pico barn is 10 to the minus 12, so this is 10 to the minus 12 barns. So this process is roughly, if I didn't screw up some numbers here, is roughly 100 pico barn. I think I did screw up number because it looks too big.
I think it's a factor of 100.
Yeah, where did I? Oh, from the 2, right?
Yeah,
okay, good. Yeah, so this should be 30. This should be 32. Ah, okay, good. Now that looked too large. So this should be 10 to the minus 12. And this is, then it's exactly a pico barn. Yeah, that's what it should be. So this process is exactly a pico barn. And so, what does this number mean? How many events of this type have I produced if I have 14 femtobarn, or roughly 10 femtobarn? We don't care about the 4. If I have 10 femtobarn, let's figure out how many such events I expect. Well, I was told here that I just have to multiply the luminosity by so number of events is equal to cross-section times luminosity. The cross-section, I just figured out, is a picobarn. And the luminosity is 10 inverse femtobarn. Well, a picobarn is 10 to the 3 femtobarn. Right? Femto is 10 to the minus 15, so femto is 10 to the minus 15. Pico is 10 to the minus 12. If you don't know those things, just go learn Latin or something. Okay, it's not that important unless you actually use those numbers, but I just want to illustrate to you how you get that. So we can just multiply, the femtobarn drops out, and I get a dimensionless number, 10 to the 4. And this is roughly how many such events you can expect in this data set. And this is why they give you this number. Because knowing the cross-section, you know how many events you can expect. Okay? Now, picobarnish is sort of a not too small, not too large a cross-section. Nowadays, we can really explore it very well. The Higgs cross-section is somewhat larger than this. I think it's like something like 10 or 20 picobarn. So you can see that we've already produced quite a lot of Higgses. But where you can see it is the problem, and most of the time you cannot see it. But what I wanted to illustrate you with this is that now you can take any kind of process you can think of, and just using dimension analysis, you can figure out what is the rough cross-section. Yeah?
But how do we know that? So you wrote down M, mass of the...
Of the selectron.
Yes.
Of the final
yes.
state.
And how do you know it's not that mass? It's not one of those masses times the mass of the electron, for example? How do you...
Because the mass... So unless there is some... You're right. In principle, it could be. But at those energy scales, the mass of the electron is basically zero. So unless there is some symmetry reason why that is so, it will never happen. The only times when something that can happen is if there is some sensitivity, if you need a helicity flip to create that. But from the diagrams, but the way the diagrams are written, you see that the mass of the electron never entered here. This could have been a vial particle, right? A vial spinner, and it would make no difference. So sometimes that happens, not in this process, but sometimes sensitivity to the masses does happen. And that's when you need an elicity flip. And it's exactly in those cases that the formalism using VAL spinners is so much helpful, because you can see explicitly that you need to a mass insertion. If I had more time, I can actually show you an explicit realization of that. That is, in fact, why the pion decays 99.99% of the time to muons and not to electrons. This simple consideration is exactly the reason for that. Okay, so generally in those sort of large high energy collisions, you'll just be sensitive to the mass of the things you produce. All right, so now we can do it for many other processes, and it's not that hard. The only thing, again, that you have to pay attention to is the there is some coupling, right? This coupling did make a big difference. This factor is 10 to the minus 4. Okay? So unless there is some symmetry reasons, these considerations will not fail you. All right, so any questions on this business, how we got this, what is the connection between this number and what you measure? You're all good?
And so Atlas can do that, and we've calculated this, so should this be detectable?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're already placing bounds, exactly because there are so many of them, they're placing bounds on how many you can see. And those bounds push this number up. And you can see, you see that this effect decouples like the square of the mass. So if it's 10 times higher, then you will start not seeing it. But this is a little bit simplistic because the selectron, whatever you produce, this particle is not a stable particle. Okay? So you have to ask how it decays. And this is something that maybe if I have 4 times towards the end, I'll discuss it a little bit. But you don't actually detect the selectron itself. You detect the decay products. And then it's a question of whether the decay products are actually detectable or not. And that's when things get a little bit more intricate. But absolutely, that is seeing that you get a number which is 10 to the 4 tells you that this is in principle detectable unless something makes it hidden. If instead we got a number which is much less than 1, then that's not detectable, because you would not have produced it yet. Do you have a question? Any other question about the rationale? And given how many events you have so many events that you can even start doing a differential measurement, right? You can ask how many of the products went in this angle, how many of the products went into this angle. And the reason why you probably want to do that, and you probably want to do more complicated things, is because you could imagine that this is not the only process that is going on, right? There is a gazillion other processes that are happening at the same time that get spewed into your detector. And you have to tell between this process and all the other garbage that is happening at the same time that you don't care about. Of course, it's a beautiful garbage that the generations previously have sorted through, and for them it was their diamonds. But for us, this is, you know, background, and what we are really after is these processes. So this separation between background and the process you want to look at is the crucial step.
This is not a LHC. This is not the process.
That's right. So that's another good point. So here, for simplicity, I've considered electron-positron because that is the simplest process, and this is what people have measured in the previous experiment, the LEP experiment. At the LHC, you don't collide electrons and positrons, you collide protons. And there is a complication, as that we'll maybe see in a moment how you deal with it. What you collide there are quarks, right? Those are quarks. There is still the same process. There is still quark-quark annihilation into photon, but quarks are not what you collide. You collide protons. So how do you convert from protons to quarks? This is something I think you probably heard about in the last lecture called parton distribution functions. There is some sort of function that converts you, that tells you, given a proton with a certain energy, what kind of quarks I can expect with what kind of momentum, Okay, and that's not something we'll cover in this course. It's a beautiful part of physics that is actually difficult to calculate and but possible to measure. And we have those things now, and that's what we'll use. I'll show you maybe, I'll show you now how to actually implement one of those things. All right, so this is all nice and dandy, but you cannot be serious if you want to do, you know, if you actually want to search for those things, you cannot come to your experimentalist and tell him, you know, I did this dimension analysis, it looks doable, go search for it. You probably want to do something more complicated than that. You actually want to calculate those diagrams. So how do we calculate those diagrams? We use Feynman rules, and that's something that we started doing in the previous class. So let me just very briefly sketch to you how you would compute it, and then we'll see how you would do it on a computer. So remember that what we're after at the end is the cross-section. And the cross-section schematically corresponds to the matrix element squared. The matrix element itself is this little diagram that we drew in first order in perturbation theory, times some phase space factor, right? In this case, it's a two-body phase space, times some kinematical factors that in the case of a two-to-two collision is something like the center of mass energy squared. So this is very, very, very schematic, but that's what it is. Okay. But more precisely, if you want to do it exactly, the way I remember it is that d sigma by d. Let me introduce one last concept. Have you ever all seen Mendelstam variables? Okay, so let me just mention that. If you have two-to-two collisions, it turns out that any kind of process like this, and those are among the most important processes in nature, because they are large enough to occur at a substantial rate. You have four momentum, right? P1, P2, P3, P4, but there are only three relativistic invariants that you can form that completely specify this process. It may be a very complicated function of those momenta, but by relativistic invariants, you know that it can only depend on those invariants. And those invariants are called the Mendelstam variables. And they are S is equal to P1 plus P2 square. It's basically four times the center, it's basically the center of mass energy square. It's four times the energy of each particle. There is what we call T, which is P1 minus P3 square. And here I'm talking about four momenta, right? So when I say P1, P2 square, what I mean is P1 mu plus P2 mu contracted against P1 mu plus P2 mu. Okay, so this is four vector notation. And lastly, there is U, which is P1 minus P4 square. And in fact, those three are not independent. There is a relation that binds them together, and that is that S plus U plus T is equal to the sum over all the masses, mi square, which is m1 square plus m2 square plus m4 square plus m3 square. Okay? So this process, no matter how complicated it is, and quantum mechanics would correct this and would make this maybe extremely interesting, but at the end of the day, it has to be a function of only S and T, or S and U. I'm assuming I'm summing over all the initial span and averaging over the span, okay? So given that, this sigma by dt, S is connected to the center of mass energy, T is related to the center of mass energy times the sinus square of the angle of scattering. Okay, so if the I think it's something like that. So if remember from this picture, the particles will scatter at some angle. T, this variable T, is related, is the relativistic invariance that tells you what is that angle in any frame. So this turns out to be 1 over, I think, 16 pi times S squared times the matrix element squared. the phase space factor and those factors all arrange themselves to give you something that is actually fairly simple. If I didn't botch it. I think I didn't. Okay, now does it make sense from dimensional point of view? Well, the dimensions of sigma is 1 over mass squared. The dimension of T is mass squared. So this hand side, right, left-hand side is 1 over energy to the fourth power. Right? This is the matrix element of 2 to 2 is always dimensionless. It's a curious fact. And so the only dimension is from S squared. And so this also goes like energy to the fourth power. So we didn't screw up the dimensions. And so now let's see how you would calculate this. Let's see if we can connect it. Yeah.
So what's the dimension of the dt is it mass squared?
Yeah, so t is dimension mass squared because it goes like energy squared. Okay, it will turn on in a moment. So once you establish this, your business is only to compute the matrix element squared. And this can be a tedious business, but now there are softwares that can do that for you, and you can even write your own software that does it. So here is that software that I showed you last time. And what I've done here is basically written something that computes that. And so we've already seen it last time, so we can just go through it quickly. The matrix element squared turns out to be this expression. Okay? Let me just make it a little larger so you can all see it. You see it better now? No? Yes? Let's see how big is real big. Is this better? Okay. So what do we have here? We have e to the fourth power. That's this alpha squares that we expected, right? There is s hat in the denominator square. The reason why I'm using s hat here is because, as I said, if you actually collide protons and not quarks, you cannot talk about the center of mass in the lab frame, because that's not the actual center of mass of the collision. So the S hat is the center of mass of the collision itself. So this looks like a fairly complicated expression, but as I promised you, it is a function only of S, U, and T. And of course, the masses of the problem, right? And here, there is only the mass of the thing you produce, which I called here MX, right? And it has the right dimensions to be a matrix element squared. You see, it is dimensionless, right? This is mass squared divided by mass of the fourth power, so it has no dimensions. Okay, so but what you care about is the actual cross section, and so for that you get d sigma by dt is this. So again, this is still a fairly complicated expression. But once you integrate it, and that's something that I've done for you already, you get a fairly simple expression. And here it is. This is the total cross section. All right? So let's stop and ponder, why do we get this answer? And it's actually an answer you can expect. So what is that answer? It says that the total cross section is e to the fourth is just 4 pi square times alpha square. That's what e to the fourth is. S hat minus 4, is I can write that as 1 minus 4 mx squared divided by s to the 3/2 divided by 432 pi times s. That's a very simple answer, right? Why is it a very simple answer? Because what it's telling me is that unless my energy, my center of mass energy, is 2 times the mass of the thing that I'm producing, this is just zero. Right? I have to go above the threshold to get any kind of production. The alpha square is just the alpha square we expected. Okay, there is a 4 pi square here, but you'll see it roughly cancels against this factor. So this factor in front is roughly 1. Now, the only thing that is a little different than what we've seen is that we expected to find that this answer should go like 1 over the mass square of the thing I produced. But this is what it will be, because you are roughly at an energy scale, right? Your center of mass energy scale is roughly at the mass of this thing that you're producing. Right? So this factor here will roughly be mx squared. Okay? But it's also telling you that once you start going to colliders which are much, much larger than the mass of the thing you're producing, the cross-section drops like the energy. So it's harder and harder to produce very light stuff. Okay? But other than that, it's a fairly simple expression, and all such cross-section will go roughly something like that. There will be a factor that just tells you that you cannot produce it unless you're above the threshold. And so we could do the same for fermions, and you'll see that indeed you get basically the same answer. Here it is. So this factor of square root s minus 4mx is basically the same thing as this factor. Right? It's just instead of 3/2, you get a half. For those of you who actually want to know a little more detail, this factor is coming from the fact that the cross-section goes like the momentum of the thing that comes out. Okay, it's scaled like the momentum. This is where you get this structure from. But other than that, it's pretty much the same thing, except for a factor of 4. This cross-section is a factor of 4 larger than producing scalars. And so generally, it's easier to produce fermions than it is to produce scalars. And that's one of the reasons that bounds, if you go for looking for what are the limits on producing Higgs xenos, those limits are much stronger than the limits of producing sleptons, for example, because sleptons are scalars. Okay? So this is how you do it. And let me, in the last 5 minutes of this class, let me show you how you can do it even on an even grander scale. This is all nice and dandy if you just want to compute a cross-section, if you just want to, you know, rather get an idea for what to expect. But it's not enough if you actually want to start simulating things. If you want to simulate those events, because ultimately, you know, there are some things you can do analytically, but at some point things get more complicated and you cannot do it analytically. And so you would like to try to simulate it. You would like to simulate events, collide two protons and get some stuff coming out. You can do that now even online. Let's see if this finished. No, didn't finish. Okay, so I'll show you how you do it on your laptop. So there is a program called MatGraph, which here is the cards for it. And it has a bunch of cards. If you open the pro card, this is the most important one. That's where you define. There's a lot of stuff, but the most important line is here. Okay? This line is telling you that you're taking proton-proton and turning it into something called B1 and B1 tilde. And those are those bottom particles. Okay, and then I'm telling it to even decay those particles. Decay those bottom into a bottom particle and a neutralino, N1. And with this command, the rest is just some trivialities. And the only other important part is that I define the model here to be the minimal supersymmetric standard model. So the program knows what is the particle content. And then you do some abracadabra, and the program gives you this. So it produced the kind of processes that you want, and if you can look at each one of them individually, and you see that this is what you had in mind. It's a quark and an anti-quark annihilating into a bottom, anti-bottom through a gluon. There is also a graph with a Z. There is a graph with the photon. So this is one type of graphs. And you also have this type of graphs. Where are they? No. Here we go. With initial state gluons, right? That you exchange this bottom and you produce the same kind of states. So this is the production, but you also see that the program does more than that. It also does the decay for you. It takes those particles and produce for each one of them two other particles that decayed. Now, this is the schematics of how it looks like. It gives you a diagrammatic representation of them. But of course, if that's all it did, it would be a pretty useless program. It produces also large files that give you the form momentum of the outgoing particles. And those form momenta is what we call an event. Okay? An event in high energy physics is when you take two particles, collide them, you get out a bunch of particles, and you get their form momenta. Once you have that, you can actually start comparing to experiment. You need a few more steps. You need to actually run them through a collider simulator and all that stuff. But once you have the basic form momenta, you are more or less done. And if you think about it, there's something very deep about it, right? Really, all that you're doing is you're telling it what is the incoming form momenta, and out of this data, you get some bunch of form momenta. So there is asymptotic incoming states, which is form momenta, and there is asymptotic outgoing states, which are form momenta. And all the complexity of quantum mechanics and the microscopic world is encoded in this information of incoming and outgoing stuff. Okay, and all the deep things that we learned about quantum field theory, supersymmetry, supersymmetric quantum field theories, gauge invariance, conformal field theories, all those beautiful and very deep stuff is coming out of this very simple type of experiments. And this is how we simulate them nowadays. Okay, so with this, we'll end this lecture. Tomorrow, Natalia will be here to teach you new stuff.